celebrating our intimate connection with the earth and the animals with whom we share it.
The natural world is not our enemy. It's far from it. You know, we go out, we look, it's a beautiful sunset, birds are singing, and that's nature. But nature is a great deal more than that. It's the old way.
That's Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. We talk with her about her memoir, Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places.
We're all part of the living world, and we've all arisen from the same source of life. And we have tremendous commonalities with the species around us. Anybody who has a dog knows that. Well, you have to first realize that we have an emotional commonality with a large spectrum of living species.
And that's wildlife conservationist Dale Peterson. We talk with him about his latest book, Where Have All the Animals Gone? My Travels with Carl Amann. That's all coming up for Earth Day on Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When Elizabeth Marshall Thomas was a young woman, her father decided to take his family on a trip to a vast and unmapped wilderness. He chose the Kalahari Desert, and the journey changed Thomas's life. She spent years with the Kalahari Bushmen, the earliest people from whom all of us are most likely descended. She learned how they mapped their territory through memory, song, and the encyclopedic knowledge they built up about their surroundings. Through her experiences with them and other peoples of Africa, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas learned the intimate rhythms that have connected human beings with the natural world for eons. It's a knowledge we lose to our peril. Thomas went on to write both fiction and nonfiction books about Africa, including The Harmless People and The Old Way. She's also the author of books about domestic animals, The Hidden Life of Dogs and The Tribe of Tiger. Her novels, Reindeer Moon and The Animal Wife, explore how life was lived in Paleolithic times. Now Elizabeth Marshall Thomas has come out with a memoir, Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. It tells not only of her years in Africa, some of which were hair-raisingly dangerous, but also about her personal struggles with addiction and family tragedy. Well, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
I love this book, Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places, both from the point of view of your sensibility in the book as well as the beautiful writing of it.
Oh, thank you.
And you start right out, I'd say, in the first pages of the book, talking about Gaia. Well, you actually talk about two concepts. There's Gaia and the old way. So tell us what you mean by Gaia and its connection with the old way.
Well, Gaia, as to the best of my knowledge, means Mother Earth, or is the Earth. And so it's just a shorthand for the Earth.
Yeah, and so you also talk about the old way, and I was just very struck. You have been in the Kalahari Desert. You've written two books about it, and this book also takes up a few chapters. I have long been enchanted by the people of the desert, the bushmen of the Kalahari or the San, ever since I read a book by Lawrence Vanderpost.
Vanderpost, yes.
And what really struck me in that book and then in your book as well is how you talk about them. You talk about them as living according to the old way. So tell us what that means.
The old way, I wrote a book called The Old Way, and it's about the Bushmen, or the San, as they're also called. And what it means is before the Neolithic, when the only people there were hunter-gatherers, our ancestors were hunter-gatherers. And that's the old way, and of course, everything that isn't a human being or a domestic animal still does live by the old way. And my fantasy, so to speak, or my picture of things, Gaia has three rules. You must protect yourself. You must find something to give you energy, food, or sunlight, or whatever, and you must reproduce yourself. Mm-hmm. And what those who live by the old way are forced to live by those rules. And so did we when we lived as our ancestors by hunting and gathering. And what I thought was interesting was it made social rules, that the people made social rules to correspond with rule one, protect yourself, which was by being, I've called them the harmless people. That was what they, my translation of their name for themselves. And it was, their social rules were for cooperation, nobody being more important than anybody else, consensus, decisions made by consensus, sharing, all kinds of things, which would reduce social stress and difficulty and would enhance cooperation. And it was through that that they were able to live. These people that I was speaking of lived in the Kalahari, a dry savanna desert with only 8 permanent water holes and 7 impermanent water holes. And at each one was an encampment where maybe 20 people, 30 people lived. So the necessity to cooperate was strong even there, because if their water hole, if it was an impermanent water hole and it didn't went dry before the rainy season, then the people would have no water and they'd have to depend on their relatives and their contacts in other encampments where they could go and be welcomed.
Now, you went there first when you were quite a young person, and you came from, we have to say, a very privileged background. Your father was the founder and CEO of Raytheon Corporation.
It was a little company then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But nonetheless, you did grow up in a privileged kind of environment.
Yeah.
And went to private schools. So tell us a little bit about how you found yourself there with your family, and how did he even know about the Kalahari?
He looked on a map. He looked on a map. He was looking for a place that had nothing on it, a blank place on a map. And there were 3. One was Antarctica, and one was the Kalahari, and the other was, I don't remember, perhaps part of Tasmania. Yeah. These were places that had not been mapped. And essentially unexplored, and to a large extent, where we went in the Kalahari was unexplored. Unexplored with quotes around it, because the people had been there for thousands of years, and they knew every bit of it. But for the Western world, it was unexplored.
Well, that's what's so striking about them. In fact, there are many people, and you refer to this in the book, who say that they were the first people, that we are all descended from them.
I believe that is thought to be the case. DNA studies have produced that.
And
that their language may be the root of all languages.
You have talked about cooperation, and I think what so interested me to begin with them was that our views, our 19th century views of the world, are that, competition, the survival of the fittest is what drives evolution. And yet these folks have survived far longer than I think we can expect our civilization to survive.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, I run into that all the time. That's a fascinating thing. The natural world is ruled by tooth and claw. And when I first wrote The Harmless People, people were all over me, anthropologists, and said, nobody is harmless. They thought I had made up the name. They didn't read the book, which says that it was my translation of the people's name. That middle syllable, it can mean clean water, clean as or pure as clean water is pure, or it means I don't have a weapon, I'm okay, or it means only or just, like it's just me, it's just the wind. Those were 3 translations of that word, or the 3 meanings of that word. And if they call themselves that, one would think they valued that quality. But people just didn't believe it. I mean, they couldn't. Also, primitive people are supposed to be, primitive quote with quotes around it, are supposed to be warlike and, fighting other primitive people. But this idea is applied throughout. I mean, we heard coyotes howling one night very recently, and somebody said they're hunting. And hunting is supposed to be aggressive, but it isn't. It's like us going to the kitchen and refrigerator. Hunting is to get food. but do animals, do people go shouting around in the woods when they're hunting? No. And the coyotes don't either. They were doing something else. But it's, that kind of a thing is assumed. And I think it was assumed of the Bushmen. When we were there, we were told they'd shoot us with poison arrows if we went there. And they were treated very badly. They were treated like animals. I mean, they were not considered to have owned the land they lived on for all that time because they didn't use it. In other words, they didn't farm it. And it was just, it's just an assumption. We still have that assumption about the natural world.
Yeah, it seems when you talk about the old way, what I, the message that I got in this wonderful book, Dreaming of Lions, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, I mean, the message that I got was that when you are open and in cooperation in relationship with the world around you, that is the old way. That is the way of survival. On the other hand, when you are in competition with the world around you and seek dominion over it, maybe that's not such a great idea.
Oh, that is certainly, would certainly be my position, yes. But interestingly enough, lions also had this. The lions did not attack people. They would come and look at our camps and look at us, and they would come once a lioness came between the Bushmen encampment and our camp, which was not a few dozen feet, maybe. And she stood there and roared and roared and roared. She was telling us something. We don't know what she was telling us. But they didn't hunt us. They didn't attack us. My brother and I were walking out in the veldt one day. We were quite far from anywhere, and we came upon a male lion. And he just, it was a very genteel meeting. We were awed by him, so we just stood in awe. And what you're supposed to do if you encounter a predator like that, you're supposed to walk away in an oblique angle. And that's what the lion did. He walked away in an oblique angle, as if he had no interest in us. That's what you're supposed to do. And people do that. When they, we were supposed to have done that when we came upon the lion. But we were too awe-stricken, and so he had to do it himself.
Yeah, and you had another very striking experience, this time with a leopard, and from what I understand from your book, leopards are a little more fierce, but you were lost, or you weren't sure if you were lost, but you were in the wilderness and trying to get back home. Tell us that story.
Well, at night, yeah, I was in Uganda with Dadaas pastoralists at that time, and they went to a dance. And I went with them, but then I found out they were going to spend the night, so that meant I had to go home by myself. And I thought they knew the way, and I'm not good at doing that, at finding the way. But I thought if I walk east, I will come upon some tracks that my vehicle made, and then I can follow those tracks back to the camp. And on the way, I heard a leopard cough. It was night, bushland, and I heard a leopard coughing. And he coughed. But what was I supposed to do? I didn't want to walk away because I didn't want him behind me because they attacked from behind. And I just didn't know what to do, so I kept going. I thought that I had, actually, I missed a point. Just before I heard him, I thought I saw the hill that our camp was on. I thought I recognized it. And I was heading for that hill. And then I heard him cough. But I thought the best thing I could do was keep going, so I did. And he coughed again. He was annoyed by this time. He was saying, you know, what do you think you're doing? I'm a leopard. But I didn't know what else to do, so I kept walking. And he coughed a third time, but very, very strongly. And still I didn't know what to do, so I kept walking at the same pace so he could hear my footsteps. And when I passed the place where he would have been, where I thought he was, he had gone. So he decided he would leave. And this kind of behavior, the lions not bothering the people, the leopard not bothering me, if he'd been hunting, he wouldn't have been coughing. He wouldn't have made any noise. So he wasn't planning to hunt me. He didn't want an encounter. And that's a very sensible thing. If you fought every time you had an encounter with something, that you'd be in rags and pieces. I mean, you'd be torn up. And it would be it's a very unwise thing. People just, we tend not to see that as a factor of the natural world, but it most certainly is. I've just finished writing another book, which is about this kind of thing, exactly. the natural world is not our enemy. It's far from it. We tend to see, you know, we go out, we look, it's a beautiful sunset, birds are singing, and, you know, that's nature. But nature is a great deal more than that. It's the old way, if you will. It's how everything has to cope and what factors they consider important to cope with.
Yeah, one of the things you say in this book, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, that you say in Dreaming of Lions, is that for every natural feature we can name, the Bushman can name 50.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, most of us, I mean, a botanist could name all the plants, but any Bushman can name all the plants.
Right. And,
you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and sometimes I think, you know, if all our technology went away or fell away for whatever reason, civilization devolved, I mean, we'd be gone in an instant.
Stuck. Yeah. That's right.
You also say the Neolithic was a bad idea. Is that where we went wrong when we started to farm?
Well, I think so. I mean, exactly as you were saying before, for 200,000 years, we lived as part of the natural world. We lived by hunting and gathering, we lived by the old way. And then farming, when we began farming and so forth, that changed everything.
Yeah, it would be the first time that we sought to control something rather than adapt ourselves to it.
Yeah, and we haven't been here any 200,000 years since the Neolithic. What is it, about 8,000?
Yeah. Yeah, not to speak of even folks 150 years ago were much more able to survive in the old way than we are at this point.
Exactly.
You mentioned before that you went to Uganda, and that's a place where, well, you met Idi Amin. Tell us about that in Uganda.
Yeah, that was really a terrible thing. The people I visited were called Dadaff, and the people, they belonged to a language group, and there was another people called Turkana who lived in Kenya, or mostly in Kenya, down the Rift Valley. And we were up near the top of the Rift Valley, not very far. And the people I was with would raid the Turkanas, and the Turkanas would raid the people that I knew. And the government at some point decided to put a stop to the raiding, and they sent the army up. And the commander of the army, I realized later, was Idi Amin. He was a colonel or a lieutenant. I'm not sure what his rank was, but in the King's African Rifles. So the soldiers came, and they went down into the Rift Valley. They had to go on foot. You couldn't drive. And they came upon a Turkana cattle post, and they just started killing people in a horrible way. The Dadaff were warriors, and they killed people. But they were upset by what Idi Amin had. Oh, Idi Amin himself, personally. There was a little girl. Her mother had been shot, and her mother was dying, and the little girl was holding her mother and crying. And Idi Amin took the little girl and broke her back with a stone. And that was too much for the Dadaff.
Yeah. Well, you also went to Nigeria, where there was a civil war, and you actually had some horrendous experiences there as well. I mean, it just seems this, you had a period of years in Africa where you witnessed terrible things and came out with it with post-traumatic stress.
I did, yeah. I did. Well, Nigeria, it was just things you saw and heard. It was just what was going on. We were never personally in danger, as far as I know. I mean, everybody was in danger, but nothing personal. But it was a bad time and a very scary time. And political disruption political problems had caused it. I went home before my husband did. We had our kids with us then, too, because when we went there, everything was fine. And to be there with your kids, we had a plan where if I was with the kids and my husband was away and something happened, I would escape with the kids and abandon him. And if it was the other way around, if he was with the kids and I was away, he would escape with the kids and abandon me. So the idea was to get our kids out of the problem. We couldn't go home. The borders were closed. All the borders, the ports, everything. I even thought of driving up to the north and walking across the border into Niger. But with two little kids, I didn't think that would work. So we just waited, and then when the time came, I did go home. And my husband came later.
Well, you've had just extraordinary experiences. Your response was to begin to drink, and you're very open in this book about how you fell into alcoholism and how you got out of it as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it makes you feel good or better for a while. It isn't a good idea. I'm not saying that, but it does make you feel better. And your troubles seem to sink, and I think that's why people do it. And then you get stuck with it. You get addicted. And it's not a good thing. And I was very glad to. I went to a drug and rehab place. It was called Beech Hill. It was here in New Hampshire. It was very near where we lived. So I went there and I met these marvelous people. Gosh, they were nice people. I'm friends with some of them. I've been friends ever since with some of them. And it was just a perfect experience. And I had a wonderful time. And came back, and that was fine. I don't find it difficult not to drink, not a bit. I mean, who wants that? You know, once it starts to cause you problems, you don't want the problems. Mm-hmm. So you just don't, and that's the easy part.
And then both your kids were hurt in terrible accidents. I mean,
they were. My daughter was run over by a truck when she was 17. And it broke her back.
A tractor?
Yes, it was a tractor. What I was thinking, it was the bucket in the front of the tractor. And trucks have them, too. And it was the point was that there was a bucket on front of the tractor with which you scoop things up with. And she and a friend were standing in the bucket riding, and the person driving, she fell out. And he ran over her. And her spine was broken. And that was... People think that this is the worst thing that can possibly happen to you. But after she was in a rehab unit, I met a guy who was, there were people there, the rehab people, some were there for checkups. And this one man was, he was in a wheelchair, but he was whisking around and reading the newspaper and talking on the phone, and he was going to go back to his job and stuff. And I thought, well, I'm going to ask him what it's like, and I did. And he said, oh, yeah, it's a nuisance, he said. And, you know, you think it's the end of the world and the worst thing that can ever happen. But as it turned out, my daughter, my gosh, she went to college. She did very well. She did lots of things. She went by herself to Fiji because we had gone to Fiji. And on the way back, we stopped in Fiji. And she met a doctor who could see how well she managed. She could take care of herself perfectly. I mean, nothing to it. And the doctor asked her to come and teach management skills to disabled Fijians. So she did. She went there for about a year by herself. And then she came back, and to make a long story short, she began work with an organization called ADAPT. And the aim of the organization was to have public transportation. That turned out to be a very large gap. The built environment is the biggest challenge to people in wheelchairs, or a huge challenge. And how do you get around? The buses and trains and all public transportation was inaccessible. Taxis were inaccessible. So ADAPT, they get big groups of disabled people. They go out and they chain themselves to buses. They stop the traffic. And they're saying, you're not going anywhere unless we go too. Mm-hmm. And it took years, and she went to jail, lots of times, 30 times maybe.
Wow.
My favorite sentence in the book is, she went to jail more times than Al Capone and exponentially more than any other Harvard graduate, which I thought was very funny. And lo and behold, public transportation is now accessible. The buses have lifts. Trains have lifts, or the platform is such that you can go in into the train like without a ramp, and that's quite something. And now, as she looks back at her time, she, I hope, feels, well, I really did something. She and her husband were leaders in that, and I'm terribly proud of them. I boast all the time about how many times she's been in jail.
That's just a wonderful story. Well, in the time we have left, I mean, this is just a wonderful book and tells many amazing stories. But you also have a chapter on writing, which is, I greatly appreciated. The show is called Writer's Voice.
And yes, I know.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, first of all, you say that writing comes from your unconscious like bubbles of swamp gas.
Yes.
But you also, I love that metaphor. That was great. So talk about that. But you also have rules, so we'll talk about them too.
Well, the swamp gas thing, I find I have no idea where it comes from, but it's boiling around in your mind, whether you're conscious of it or not. So when you then you start working and up it comes, and you can get a terrific sentence just out of the blue, and you find yourself writing it. Now, that's got to be the unconscious mind that's doing that. I mean, you have to set it up. You have to figure out what you're going to write about. But once you've got it figured out, then the writing part seems to me to come like that.
That's just a wonderful metaphor. But you also have some rules, and we can't go over all of them, but tell us some of the rules that you have in writing.
Well, I decided not to do the book chronologically because I thought that would be boring.
And you do it by topic. I mean, it is kind of roughly chronological, but it has a logic to it that's not of chronology.
Yes, it's roughly, yeah.
Right. And you also have what rule about using Anglo-Saxon words.
Oh, yes,
instead of Latin words.
Well, I wrote a book called Reindeer Moon about the Upper Paleolithic. And it's a first-person narrative that one of the people is telling the story. So I made a very strong point of not using any Latin-derived words if there was any possibility of an Anglo-Saxon word to use instead. Because it gives the book a quality. It's a down-to-the-earth quality. And it's believable to me that a Paleolithic person would use that kind of vocabulary and would never use the kind of fancier words, the Latinate words. That you can't always avoid it. But I could write a sentence with, or a short sentence with Anglo-Saxon words rather than using a Latinate word. So I tried to do that all the time, too. And I think it's generally better. It sounds better. It has a sort of maybe lighter touch or a more down-to-earth touch.
Well, this was a wonderful book to read, Dreaming of Lions, My Life in the Wild Places. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts about this book with us and for coming on to our show.
Well, thank you for asking me. Very nice.
Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. You can read two chapters from Dreaming of Lions by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, how our appetites are driving our closest animal relatives to extinction and what we can do to stop it. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our closest animal relatives, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos, are going extinct. One reason is habitat loss from encroaching human populations. But another reason might surprise you, the globalization of the bushmeat trade. It seems like eating endangered species gives a thrill to the global elite. And it's not just apes. Elephants are being decimated for the international ivory trade. And giraffes are being squeezed by too many human beings. Over the last 15 years, wildlife conservationist Dale Peterson has teamed up with photographer Carl Amann to produce three books about apes, elephants, and giraffes. His latest is Where Have All the Animals Gone? It chronicles the pair's travels through Africa and Southeast Asia on the trail of vanishing wildlife. As the authors say, it's not the end of the world, it's the end of the wild. Dale Peterson has written many books on wildlife conservation, as well as a biography of Jane Goodall. He also created the Henry David Thoreau Prize for Literary Excellence in Nature Writing. Dale Peterson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you, Francesca.
This book, Where Have All the Animals Gone? My Travels with Carl Amann, is a narrative of travels in Asia and Africa with the photojournalist and wildlife photographer Carl Amann. You call it an eccentric and tragicomic look at our vanishing wild world, as well as being a personal portrait of the photographer. I get the tragedy, but why tragicomic?
Well, there's always comedy even in the midst of tragedy, isn't there? And I think our daily lives, when we were in the travels, had lots of comic elements to them, and there was lots of laughter and lots of strange things. And, you know, there's a lot of pleasure in traveling with people, going to exotic places, and even when the exotic places essentially show you a tragedy happening, an environmental tragedy.
Yes, exactly. And I almost wondered whether the comedy was meant to try to leaven what is, after all, an absolutely heart-wrenching and devastating wholesale extinction of wild animals. And, you know, I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, it's part of climate change, which is part of it. But it's also really part of human societies kind of breaking down, corruption becoming king, of globalization, in fact. I mean, there seem to be a lot of social factors that are even larger than, let's say, the climatological ones, although, of course, those are driven by social factors as well.
You know, we think of climate change as driven by industrial technology, cars burning gasoline and so on. But we also have to remind ourselves that since the Industrial Revolution, the number of people on this planet has increased by tenfold. And if you had 10% of, you know, the current level of automobiles on the roads, we wouldn't have climate change, I don't think. So it really comes back to human population growth. We're taking over the planet and turning all of the wild places into essentially feedlots for humans. So it shouldn't surprise us that, you know, non-humans are disappearing. The globalization, of course, is a second part of this picture. You know, we're expanding our reach, and one of the things that I'm most familiar with is the opening up of the Congo Basin rainforest, which began at, you know, a very particular moment in the late 1980s when European and Asian loggers moved into Central Africa with modern machinery and began opening up this great ecosystem that is, 65 million years old. So it's just a tragedy. And worse, it's not reflected in the price of wood that you can buy in Europe and Asia now, even though this wood is being taken from these ancient forests. And it's destroying this ancient ecosystem. Nobody's paying for this. We just figure this is free. And it is free, except, of course, the cost that is going to be paid by our grandchildren and their grandchildren and so on.
And the cost is being paid now by the animals.
By the animals, yes.
So you went there to Kenya, Uganda, Gabon, the Central African Republic, Congo, and Namibia. You start the book out with talking about bushmeat, and this follows up on another book that you wrote with Carl Amann called Eating Apes. So talk about bushmeat. Why has this suddenly become such a terrible danger to the chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos?
Well, this is how Carl and I first met, was I began to realize he was photographing this phenomenon of this commercial trade in live animal meat that included the meat of great apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, and bonobos. And because there was no American journal of any sort, natural history journal or otherwise, that would publish Carl's photographs or stories, I told him I would write a book. And that was the start of my first travels with Carl, was to write that book. Carl was taking photographs. I was investigating the situation. And that does take us back to the problem of European and Asian loggers coming into the Congo Basin rainforests and essentially putting in logging roads and opening up this ecosystem. With the logging roads, all of a sudden, you had a completely different situation. There's always been subsistence hunting of wild animals in Africa for food. And some of those animals, you know, essentially all kinds of animals are vulnerable to being hunted. But once the European and Asian loggers opened up the roads, then you had industrial hunting, you had commercial hunting with people taking out large numbers of exotic animals, taking them out to the big cities, and marketing them as exotic gourmet foods for people living an urban life who wanted to have a vision of what, you know, the rural life of their grandparents may have been like. So you have this cultural interest in these exotic foods, and that's being used as a marketing tool for selling these exotic meats that are now going large numbers and, you know, massive amounts going into the cities. That was the story. So my first trip with Carl into Africa was to investigate that story, see if it was true, to meet some professional gorilla hunters in Cameroon and interview them and to walk through the forests and to, you know, meet some of the loggers and just see for myself the situation. And yes, it's grim and it sounds awful and it sounds like you don't want to hear about this, which is, you know, the reaction of a lot of people. Please, I don't want to know the bad news. That's okay, but the book that I wrote, I think, presented this bad news at least in a way that was, you know, legitimate. So I broke through the barrier of people not wanting to talk about it. The story of Carl, of course, is the other story, which is just the adventures we had traveling together.
So talk a little bit about the impact on these populations, chimpanzees, gorillas, and bonobos. These are our closest relatives.
Well, that's right. So the impact is much bigger than anybody realized. And we did, you know, enough surveys of markets and so on. It's still underground, so it's like, you know, selling an illegal drug in this country. It's not legal to sell ape meat anywhere in Africa, nor is it legal to sell elephant meat, which is also sold. So you're looking at an underground economy, but it's like really, in many places, it's like it's like the marijuana economy in California. It's underground, but not very far underground. It's not, you know, there's a cultural acceptance of it in some places. So the impact, you know, it's impossible to actually gauge it, although people have done, you know, assessments of the total amount of biomass coming out of the forests every year. And that's a very complex judgment to make, and it's obviously an estimate, but it's certainly much larger than anything you would imagine is sustainable. And I certainly think that's true with gorillas and chimpanzees and bonobos. You know, bonobos in particular, there may only be a few thousand, maybe 5,000, maybe 45,000 left, but it's a small number. I mean, you could fit the entire species into a, you know, a single large stadium in this country. Gorillas, the numbers are a little bit higher, but not that much higher. So the impact is clearly bad. And one of the ways that we measure it is that we see there are orphans created. You know, the hunter shot the mother. The mother lost the baby, and the baby is not worth anything as meat because he's too small. So then you've got a live baby that may, you know, if the baby isn't cared for, may live for a few days. And sometimes these babies are sold to people who just want a pet. And they're a good pet for until they get stronger than the owner, which happens very quickly. But that now there are orphanages all over Africa essentially set up to provide for a sudden influx of ape infants appearing across the forested middle of the continent.
One of the things you say in your book, Dale Peterson, and Where Have All the Animals Gone, is that there's a controversy over these sanctuaries, that there's a perceived almost zero-sum game between conservation and sanctuaries for animals, like these ape orphanages. Talk a little bit about the issues there and where you stand on that.
Well, I personally don't see it as a controversy because I guess I'm on the side of the orphanages. I don't know how can you look at a baby chimpanzee who just is so close to a baby human that you You know, I've known of people who go onto planes with a baby chimpanzee and just pay the price for a baby human. They're very close to baby humans, so what do you do with them? Can you just put them down, kill them? The controversy is because the orphanages cost money. People say, well, why don't you spend that money on protecting a forest? But, you know, really, we should have enough money to do both. And you can make good arguments for the value of orphanages. First of all, they're places where a lot of people can see chimpanzees who wouldn't otherwise have any idea that these animals are living in the forest. And secondly, I think they present a position that is, these are very valuable animals, and we cannot, in good conscience, ethically, simply kill them because it's inconvenient to take care of them.
In terms of battling this, you talk in the book about going to Gabon, and you talk about the president, I don't know if he's still the president, President Bongo. And you have a few paragraphs that are written with a pretty acid pen about how just totally corrupt he is, which brings up the larger issue of how can you do conservation in an atmosphere of corruption?
Yes, there is a lot of corruption, and President Bongo is no longer president. And although I'm not following the politics of Gabon in recent years, his son replaced him when Bongo died. But he did do very good things for conservation, and I'll have to give him that credit. Gabon is a relatively wealthy country in Africa, and it also is wealthy in terms of biodiversity, which means it has still a good deal of intact forests. And Bongo set up a whole series of national parks, at least established them and defined them. So this was a great gift to the world, and I, you know, in spite of my complaints about his financial doings, there is the other side that he will be remembered for the conservation gift. So you have to deal with what you're given. And if the country is not run well, that's a problem, but you still work with it.
But then the larger issue of corruption in general, I mean, as you mentioned, it's not legal to sell bush meat of
yes.
the apes,
right.
and yet it's done. I mean, the corruption goes all the way through from top to bottom. And
This is a conversation I've had with Carl Amann all the way. So Carl is tends to be nihilistic about this. I tend to be a little bit more positive and think it's bad, it could be worse, it could be better, and our job is to try to make it better.
Yes, and within that context, if we are going to conserve, do we need a major shift in the way human beings regard our moral stance towards the other animals with whom we share the earth? Because, you know, you can pass laws, but if there's corruption, those laws are going to be violated. And not to say that you shouldn't pass them, but it seems that it needs to come along with a concomitant shift about the rights of the animals that we're talking about here, rights that can be also part of law as well as culture.
Right. Well, when you talk about rights, you talk about formalizing a relationship. And in order to formalize that, you have to have it to begin with. And so I'm interested in the relationship itself, which is an emotional relationship. Do you care about animals, and do you feel that they have, you know, significance because they have emotions, because they have awareness? If you feel that, then that's the emotional background. I mean, morality is based on emotions. It's not based on law. And rights is sort of a legal, putting something into a legal framework, putting it into language. I would like to get to the emotions first, and I would like to persuade people that animals are important and that we should care about them, because they have a reality. They're psychologically aware. They're alive. They're not objects. And that's if you call yourself an animal rights person, you want to put into writing, and you want to put it essentially into a legal and a written level. You know, I'm focused on the emotional level, and that's where my writing concentrates.
It does seem to me, though, that to entertain the idea of the rights of animals, it begins as a moral precept, a moral concept.
Well, that's right, and I would like to move us in that direction. But again, morality is an emotional experience. You feel that something is right. You feel that something is wrong. And until you have that emotional experience, you don't have the moral experience.
Well, in the moral rights, the moral lives of animals, your previous book to this one, Where Have All the Animals Gone?, you talk about something you call anthropo-exceptionalism. Tell us what that is. And what's problematic about it?
Well, the most problematic thing is it's a very hard word to say. People talk about anthropomorphism, you know, imagining that an animal is really a person covered in fur. But there's the almost the reverse position, which is imagining that we have absolutely nothing in common with animals. And we don't have a word for that, so I invented the word for the purpose of my discussion in the book. And I don't think this coinage is going to go very far, just because it's a very hard word to say, anthropo-exceptionalism. But the meaning of it, I think, is pretty clear, and the meaning is, you know, that we humans are so exceptional that we're unrelated to any other life on the planet. And that is so contrary to what any biologist will tell you, because, of course, we're all part of the living world, and we've all arisen from the same source of life. And we have tremendous commonalities with the species around us. Anybody who has a dog knows that, you know, that there's an emotional commonality. So that's sort of the background that you have to start talking about when you talk about, you know, the morality of animals, which is the subject of that book. You have to first realize that we have an emotional commonality with a large spectrum of living species.
I interviewed Carl Safina about his latest book, Beyond mm-hmm. Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And I kept on stepping on my feet because I kept on kind of drawing out the point how much the animals are like us. And he kept on turning it around and saying, yeah, but what's really interesting is how animals are in their own right, and that we need to respect them on that basis. Something that you also talk about in the book, The Moral Lives of Animals, where you talk about understanding that they have minds, but they're minds that are alien to us, that we,
right.
So I wonder if you could just follow that along. It seems like a small distinction because, after all, you know, first we're going to care about something that's like us. But then it seems like there's the further point that's very important, stressed by you and by Safina, that we need to also recognize animals as separate from us. So if you could kind of draw out what's underneath that distinction, and why is it important?
Well, I think it's important only because it's reality, and I think the reality is that animals are not humans, and they're different from us, and we already know that. But the important point is how similar they are. So I admit the differences, and I'm completely open to any discussion about how different that particular species is from me, but I think we have not, as a culture, talked about the similarities, and we have not even adjusted to the similarities, the idea of similarities, particularly on the psychological and cognitive level. And so, you know, even though Carl Safina wants to emphasize the difference, and any good scientist will, he's also written a book about similarities. So I kind of would argue your position a little more strongly than his. Yes, of course there are differences, and there will be a thousand ways in which, you know, we can never understand the mental world of another species, because they are aliens, but they're aliens that we share evolutionary history that goes back for millions and millions, billions of years. And it's in that shared history, that ancestral history, that we find that the similarities come from. So my argument in, you know, Moral Lies of Animals is that there are some huge similarities having to do with moral systems associated with what we call, among humans, morality. We've placed morality into language, and we talk about it in language, and we even imagine that without language we wouldn't have morality. But I think that's completely wrong. I think, look, you know, language enables us to conceptualize it and to put it into a framework and to imagine that, you know, a deity handed us this whole list of moral behaviors that we should follow. But the moral behaviors existed before language. And they have to do with an evolved system for living in groups. You know, how do you associate with other individuals in your groups? That's the basis of morality. And it's an emotional basis. We have an emotional system that we codify as morality.
I'd like to go back to Where Have All the Animals Gone? My Travels with Carl Amann, Dale Peterson, your most recent book. This is really a book that is designed to get people up in arms about the terrible, you know, the Holocaust that's really happening to animals, not just in Africa, but also in Asia, really all around the planet, but specifically in those countries, Asia, in those continents, Asia and Africa. Recently, President Obama came out with an initiative to save the elephants. Elephants are one of the creatures that you follow in this book. I wonder what you think about that.
I'm actually not familiar with the details of that initiative. I think everything that can be done should be done. I also think that, you know, there are two major parts of the world where we can have an impact, and those are those parts of the world where ivory comes from, African nations and Asian nations. And then the second part is where ivory goes. And those are the nations that are the big importers. And the big importers are in Asia. China is probably the biggest. But certainly America also is apparently a big dealer in ivory. And so I agree that we need to change our laws as much as possible to eliminate and end the ivory trade completely. And you know, assuming that part of the Obama initiative is to do this, I certainly absolutely applaud it. And of course, we can also affect things going on outside of the American legal system by supporting conservation and supporting a changed attitude towards elephants and towards ivory in, you know, the elephant parts of the world.
So tell us what really needs to be done if we are to save elephants, giraffes, bonobos, chimpanzees, and gorillas from extinction.
Well, I'm glad you expanded the picture here, because these are all very different species with very different problems. You know, only elephants have ivory, so elephants have this almost unique problem of being, their teeth are desired by people. So they're being extinguished because people want those teeth. So there are differences, you know, behind the differences, of course. We talked about this earlier, which is this unprecedented human dominance of the planet and human expansion in numbers tenfold since the early 1800s. Which underlies everything, and everything is related to that. In Africa, you know, just people are moving into places where elephants used to migrate, so elephant migration routes are being blocked. This is similar to giraffes, who are losing their territory, and giraffes are actually, their numbers are going down very, very fast. And that's even a little bit harder to understand, because what do people get from giraffes? Well, there's no ivory, but I think some of it is just this animal is in my backyard, I don't want him here, I'll kill him. And, you know, a lot of it is they're just losing their habitat. So I guess you asked a question about what to do, and I described the problem.
Right.
But I think, you know, the solution is in some ways to reverse the problem. And in the very long term, I think we must, you know, at some point, human populations have to stabilize. I think there's also, you know, the old-fashioned solution, which is setting aside large pieces of wilderness to become national parks and so on. And I'm certainly in favor of that, and I'd like to see a lot more of that. And creating corridors between wilderness habitats is also a wonderful idea. The larger idea is keeping large, large pieces of biodiversity-rich habitats free from human intrusion, I completely agree with, and I think that's one of the most important solutions. It may require international cooperation, and it may require a lot of attention, which means money, and that, in turn, requires human awareness. So what I work on as a writer is human awareness, and once you have awareness and people are aware of it and then care about it, then you have money and you have political will. And then once you have that, I think the rest of it will follow.
I hope we have the time to do all that.
Well, I hope so too.
Well, Dale Peterson, thank you so much for talking with us here about your two books, Where Have All the Animals Gone?, the most recent one, My Travels with Carl Amann, and The Moral Lives of Animals.
Well, thank you, Francesca.
Dale Peterson has written many books on wildlife conservation, as well as a biography of Jane Goodall. He also created the Henry David Thoreau Prize for Literary Excellence in Nature Writing. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.